In the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, I'm going to go through today the book of Nehemiah, at least in part. And I want to go back and maybe just remind us a little bit about the time flow here and the story flow. You start out with Joshua and Zerubbabel. And we almost forget about them because it's the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. But Joshua and Zerubbabel started out and they returned with the Jews to Jerusalem to reestablish Jerusalem, to rebuild the city, to rebuild the temple, to worship there, and to turn the people, in that sense, back to God. And so they returned to the land and they ran into an enormous amount of trouble and frustration. And the people really weren't as responsive to that task as they would have liked, but in the course of that, they did get the temple built. And then there's a time of decline. And then Ezra looks around, and God working with Ezra. Ezra had it in his own mind to go now and try to return and restore the people again to God, to worship, and to establish them, and to bring the law back and more firmly root it among the people in their worship of God. And so Ezra returns and had quite a battle, frankly. We went through the last Bible study how he brought with him not only the written law but the oral law. He was a priest and a scribe, and I tried to show the significance of that and how decisions were made and how that still affects us even today. But the fact is, there were problems in the land when Ezra arrived, and they got worse after he got there, not better. Jerusalem didn't have any means of protecting itself yet. There was no wall in the city. And so the people had scattered from Jerusalem because it wasn't a safe place to congregate. It would be like going to a place where a lot of people were that was a target of attack, and making yourself more exposed. And so the people tended to scatter out and also over the land to make a living and almost to fend for themselves. And as a result, the construction in Jerusalem ceased. Then we have Nehemiah, who came along later again to return and hold up Ezra's hands and still to finish the wall, and gave Ezra a chance to then give the law. The fact is, the law that Ezra gave took a long time to put in place. It took a long time to put in place. So I'd like to go back now, and we'll look at, we'll start in the book of Nehemiah, because we've moved through to that point. Today, if I have time, in the course of the hour, I'll give you some dates and some figures, and those I think are only important, unless you're a professional historian where you have to keep track of those things. They're only important in a relative context. It's not something you're going to use this week when you go back to work or whatever you do. But it is important to understand how God works, what was happening in the Bible, so that when you read Ezra and Nehemiah, you have some background to what was taking place. Now, the book of Nehemiah is some of the last recorded material in the Old Testament. Malachi is at the very end in terms of the order and also in time frame. Malachi is largely prophecy. Nehemiah is history. And so in terms of time reference, even though it's not in the last part of the Old Testament, historically it's at the end of the time period of the recorded history of the Old Testament. Nehemiah chapter 2, you can see Nehemiah's request to go to Judah. It says, it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, that I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had never been sad in his presence before. And the king said to me, why are you so sad? Are you not sick? Or says, since you are not sick. He says, this is nothing but sorrow of heart. And I became dreadfully afraid. You know, the king then had the power of life and death. Everyone served at his pleasure. He didn't have a court of appeals. He didn't have to answer to anyone. And so anything you did that was displeasing to the king could have indeed cost you your life. Now, it so happened that Nehemiah was a very trusted aide to the king. And so he responded to the king. He says, may the king live forever, That's a good thing to say if you're getting ready to answer for yourself. First, you want to stroke the king a little bit. He said, "Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies waste? Its gates are burned with fire." The king said to me, "What do you request?" And so I prayed to the God of heaven, and I said to the king, "If it pleases the king and your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tomb, so that I may rebuild it." The king said to me, and the queen was sitting there with him, "How long will your journey be, and when will you return?" And it pleased the king to send me, and I set him a time. Furthermore, I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, let letters be given to me from the governors of the region beyond the river, so that they will permit me to pass through till I come to Judah, and a letter to this keeper of the king's forest, so that he'll give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel which pertains to the temple, for the city wall, for the house that I will occupy." And the king granted them to me according to the good hand of my God that was upon me. Now, when he goes back to Judah, there were numerous problems. Ezra's already there. Joshua and Zerubbabel long since been there. And yet there were fundamental problems still in place. The first problem was all of Judah's neighbors were enemies to Judah and opposed them. If you go on down from here, verse number 9, it says, "I went to the governors of the region beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. And when Sanballat and Tobiah heard of it, they were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. It was not to their advantage that Judah, Israel, whichever you'd call it in this case, would be strengthened and solidified in their midst. Sanballat was the Persian-appointed governor of Samaria. Tobiah was the Persian-appointed governor of Ammon. And so all of these areas were under Persian rule, but these were governors of the neighboring states. There's another individual who is an enemy that in Nehemiah 6:1 his name is mentioned. Now it happened when Sanballat, governor of Samaria, Tobiah, governor of Ammon, Geshem the Arab, Geshem here is a governor of the area that's south and east of Judah and was actually their principal enemy. Geshem was a relative of the Persian king. He was a member at some lineage of the royal family. And so he could get away with things that some other people could not because of the connections that he had. And so Geshem here was one of the principal enemies, but Sanballat and Tobiah were enemies as well. What had happened? Part of southern Judah was now inhabited by Edomites. Who in the New Testament was an Edomite? Very significant, famous person in the New Testament was an Edomite. Anybody? King Herod. King Herod was an Edomite. And so the Edomites had moved out of their land into the southern part of Judah. When Judah went into captivity, you know, there was this big open space, and so this population just kind of moved into the southern part. Arabs then, this Geshem, and the part of the land that he ruled, moved in behind the Edomites. As Edom vacated some of their property, the Arabs tightened in and moved in behind them, because the further you go out, the greater the desert is. And so they're moving into these stronger areas, and the situation became permanent. And so Judah comes back into the land, but they can't really reoccupy the land because other peoples have moved in and others have moved in behind them, and those people happen to be their enemy. And so when Judah returned, the neighbors were opposed to them. The economy was in a shambles, and I say under the time of Nehemiah, which is at this point in history. The wall was still not finished. That left them open to raids from their enemies. Because they didn't have a wall and a proper defense, the population of Jerusalem was very low. It was simply safer to live somewhere else. If you don't have a defense force, you don't have a workforce, you can't build the wall, restore the city. Some of the leaders as well of the Jews were traitors. The high priest, Eliashib, was allied with Tobiah. We see that at the end of the book. And so the high priest had allies with these other nations, even against his own people. Eliashib's grandson, the high priest's grandson, was married to Sanballat's daughter, the governor of Samaria. And that's significant, and again, I'll address that later. The Jews were still profaning the Sabbath. There was a lack of social justice. The poor were being taken advantage of. Some were being forced into slavery. The temple system itself was not functioning, and the Levites had had to leave their jobs to support themselves. And so what began with great promise and hope, and we look at Joshua and Zerubbabel as having accomplished this great thing. Well, it was great from where they started, but it didn't last. It didn't stay. And Ezra came along, and it still didn't stay. And so now Nehemiah comes along behind to shore up and to restore and to give his weight to that responsibility as well. Now, Nehemiah 1, verse number 11, mentions here, Nehemiah says, O Lord, I pray, please let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant, to the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name, and let your servant prosper this day. Grant him mercy in the sight of this man. I am the king's cupbearer. So as Nehemiah here is crying out, this little insert is put in that he was the cupbearer. Now, we shouldn't think of that as some kind of a menial position, as a servant who just carries the cup and washes the dishes and things for the king. The cupbearer was the one who protected the king in that sense. One of the ways to get at the king would be to poison his wine or food or in some way try to damage and injure the king. And so this was a personal aide who was highly trusted with the most intimate things. And he had, in that sense, an impact on the protection of the life of the king. And so he wasn't just there as a busboy moving dishes. He was a very well-trusted and responsible person. When you then go through the book of Nehemiah and you see the leadership that he evidenced, it's a remarkable study on its own merits. One of the greatest examples of leadership in the Bible is in Nehemiah's own life. Some of the qualities that he had. The very first quality I would point out is that he consistently put God first. He depended on God for his success, and he did not trust in self. And we see that over and over again. Nehemiah 1, verse 1. It says, the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, came to pass in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, I was in Shushan, the citadel, and Hanani, one of my brethren, came with men from Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, who had survived the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity in the province are there in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down. The gates are burned with fire. And so it was when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned for many days. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. The first thing he did was he went to God, and then he went to the king. He didn't go to the king and then ask God to intercede and bless him as well. He went to God first. He consistently, you go through the book, when he ran into a crisis, he immediately turns to God, and then he carries on with his responsibilities, seeking that blessing to be put in place. Nehemiah 4. It happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, so it's down in time here in terms of what is now being accomplished. But when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he was furious and indignant, and he mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren, the army of Samaria, and said, what are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned? Now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, whatever they build, even if a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. And Nehemiah cries out, hear, O God, for we are despised. Turn their reproach on their own heads and give them as plunder to a land of captivity. Over and over again, Nehemiah cries out to God, and then he responds. Down in verse number, continuing on verse 5. Do not cover their iniquity. Do not let their sin be blotted out from before you, for they have provoked you to anger before the builders. So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored, the gaps were beginning to be closed, They became very angry, and all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and to create confusion. Nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them, we set a watch against them day and night. Too often, brethren, I think we all strive. Sometimes we reach out and we grab a hold of circumstances and try to fix them to work the way we believe they should. Nehemiah put his shoulder to the wheel as such. He inserted himself and applied his great efforts to the task, but he always put to God first, turned to God first, cried out to God, prayed to God, and then continued on with his work. And that's important. That's important in the church. I to this day don't know what God wants to do in terms of witness work, in terms of growth or stability. I don't know what God has in mind. But we have to submit ourselves to him and ask him. And then we do. We have to apply. Part of what I want to address in the sermon today is the necessity for us to apply our effort and to let God bless what we do. And to see what it is that God blesses. Instead of demanding God to bless something because we're vested in it, to actually look around and see where God's hand is. We talk about the feast, and we say where God has placed his name. Now, if we just walk out and say, I like this, we're going to do this, now God, honor what I have bound, I think our attitude is in sad disrepair. We need to actually look to discern where God's blessing is, and where he has granted us favor and opportunity. And we need to do so in the church. But Nehemiah consistently turned to God and then continued with the task at hand. Verse 13, therefore I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings, and I set the people according to their families with their swords, spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles and the leaders and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord great and awesome, and fight for your brethren and your sons and your daughters, your wives and your houses. Remember God and then fight to protect what God has granted us to do. And it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had brought their counsel to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. When they recognized that God, as Nehemiah here is recording, as it is written, when God brought their counsel to nothing, they did not even go up and attack. They did not have, in other words, the people were accomplishing their task. I was having a discussion. My son is in for the weekend from Seattle and flew in Friday and he flies back out Sunday. And we were just having a discussion this morning. I was downstairs working on my notes, and he came down to the office, and we were talking. And he was, he sees my books on the shelf, and of course, here's a book on, I borrowed from the Kottke's, Mein Kampf. It's sitting on my desk, and then I got a book on Hitler on the shelf. He says, what, do you have some kind of fascination with Hitler or something? I said, well, I think that he had a significant impact on history, and we began to talk about leadership. And he says, you know, it's remarkable how so many leaders were in one place at one time in the history of our nation and this world. He was talking about World War II and Churchill and others as well. And I said, well, I believe that was something that God provided for. I said, where great evil rises up, God provides for great leadership to counter that so that his will be fulfilled. But we have to depend on God to make provision for that which he will have us to do. We can't imagine if he called us that he wouldn't give us the tools to finish on through and continue to salvation to the kingdom. And so in the same sense, in this earth, even when we see trouble around us, if we really truly trust God, then we will understand that he will give us provision to do what it is we must do. But Nehemiah here consistently, he said, don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and fearsome, and fight for your brethren. Put God first, and then do your part. And I think the second part of what Nehemiah did in terms of leadership is just that. He did trust in God, and God did come first, and he was very careful in that respect. But he was also careful to do his part. You can't just sit, God can only bless an effort. You can't just say, okay, God, you know, what is it you want to do now? Let it be done. Let us all just let somebody else do what it is that we're supposed to do. when we read Nehemiah 2 to start with, he went and got an order from the king. He came with the authority of the king of the empire so that he could go forward and fulfill his task. Back in Nehemiah 2, when Nehemiah arrived in Jerusalem, you know, it's easy to just have a bunch of reports come to you and then try to make a decision, but Nehemiah understood that it was important that he understand firsthand and without somebody trying to influence him what the situation was. But Nehemiah 2, verse 11, when he went out to see the damage himself, he said, I came to Jerusalem, and I was there 3 days. And I arose in the night, I and a few men with me, and I told no one what God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the one on which I rode. So he didn't go out there with this great entourage. He says, I went out by night through the valley gate and the serpent well and the refuse gate. It's hard because we don't live in Jerusalem to portray and picture what is here. The serpent well here is in other places in the Bible called Gihon, the Gihon Spring. And it fed the pool of Siloam. Hezekiah's tunnel was dug 250 years earlier to bring water in from this area, from the serpent well, and to bring the water into the pool of Siloam. Now, in the New Testament, Jesus, who sent the blind man to wash in the pool of Siloam, was sent to here, but the water's coming out of this one place. They call it a serpent well because there was a legend at that time that there was a dragon in the rock and the water would tend to gush out of the well like it came out in surges or breaths, and it was like they called it the serpent well because of the legend that there was a dragon in there pushing out the water. But not that that's so biblically important, but that's where the name came from. But Hezekiah dug a tunnel from this well inside where the gates would be so that Jerusalem would have access to the water in times of siege or trouble. But he went around to these places. It says, the walls were broken down, its gates were burned with fire. And then I went on to the fountain gate in the king's pool, but there was no room for that animal that was under me to pass. So much rubble and destruction. I went up in the night by the valley and viewed the wall, and I turned back and entered by the valley gate and returned. And the officials didn't know where I had gone or what I had done. I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials are the ones who did the work. I've heard Aaron Dean mention sometimes the criticism in regard to Mr. Armstrong and the way he made decisions because he didn't get good input. And I've heard Aaron mention on a number of occasions that when he got good input, he made good decisions. And Nehemiah here goes out and says, well, I must see this for myself. I need to understand. And I don't want someone coming along and trying to interpret it for me. And so he went out in that sense and saw it for himself. The next task was to get enough people involved to actually accomplish the job. And in chapter 3, you see this, when Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with his brethren, he had encouraged the people to begin to build now. And so the high priest, even though he was a traitor, is still having to play the game and participate because it's in front of the people now. But it says, they rose up with his brethren the priests and they built the sheep gate and they consecrated it and hung its doors. And it says they went as far as the Tower of the Hundred. Next to Eliashib, the men of Jericho built, and also the sons of Hassanah built the fish gate. And what he did was he included everyone in the task. It was a team effort. And he gave everybody something to do. And it's interesting as well, if you go down to verse 28, And I think this is a principle that United is trying to apply. United is a work in progress. The way we function now is not exactly the way we functioned maybe 3 years ago, and I'm not sure exactly how we'll function in 3 years, but in terms of where the focus is, you know, we've gone through these arguments over how much local focus, how much central focus, who should run everything, who should have opportunity, but there is built in here to the text something where Nehemiah, to give the people incentive to produce, allowed them to do the things which interested them the most and gave them vested interest. And verse 28 says, beyond the horse gate, the priests made repairs each in front of his own house. Now, if you lived in Jerusalem and the wall was all busted down, there's a big hole in the wall right in front of your front door. Where's the first place you'd be willing to work the hardest? Right there. And so he took the people and he let them do that thing which they had vested interest in because they would do the best. I guarantee you, if I'm putting the wall up in front of my house, that's going to be the best place I ever built. Right there. The hardest, the most dedicated I think I would ever do because you want that. And it says, after that, Zadok, the house of Immer, made repairs in front of his own house. In verse 30, after him, Meshulam made repairs in front of his dwelling. And so Nehemiah had a way of encouraging teamwork and motivating the people in such a way that the task would be accomplished. Chapter 4. But it so happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, and I read part of this, he was furious, and he threatened the people in that sense. Verse number 7. When Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored, the gaps were beginning to be closed, they became very angry. And it goes on down, and the part that I mentioned is how he prayed to God, and then he directed, and he said, verse 10, then Judah said, the strength of the laborers is failing. There is much rubbish. There's so much rubbish we're not able to build the wall. And our adversary said they will neither know or see anything till we come in their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came, then they told us 10 times from whatever place you turn, they will be honest. Now there began to be this unreasoning fear among the people as to what was going to happen and take place. And so Nehemiah here gave them a very strong and strenuous encouragement in directing them to God, but he did it in an organized way. You can encourage people to trust God, but if you keep shooting yourself in the foot and you do things in an irresponsible manner, they're still going to be discouraged. Sometimes in the church, we embarrass ourselves. We just embarrass ourselves. And I watch in my own mentality, and I watch in the church this wave of emotion roll through because of an action or a decision that was made in such a way that we go, how? Why are we doing this? And Nehemiah here was very, very careful to put the people in order, to give them tasks and responsibilities. If you go through and you read it, it talks about how they built the wall, and some worked while some protected, and some were just very, very diligent. Verse 16, so it was from that time on, half of my servants worked at construction, the other half held the spears, the shields, the bows, and wore armor. And the leaders were behind all the house of Judah. Those who built on the wall and those who carried burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction, the other hand held a weapon. Not the fastest way to work, but he's just saying we were doing this in such a way that we had the confidence to believe that we would be able to continue. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built, and the one who sounded the trumpet was besides me. He set up a system of alarm saying, you will be able to work because I will give you warning. And then there will be time to arise and defend ourselves. Then I said to the nobles, the rulers, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive. We're separated far from one another on the wall. Therefore, wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, to rally to us there, and our God will fight for us. So we labored in the work, and half of the men held the spears from daybreak until the stars appeared. It takes more, though, than good sense. It really takes what we would call zeal and dedication, and Nehemiah was very personally dedicated in such a way that the people came to trust and look to him in a way that gave them confidence. But you see this in verse 21. They labored the work, half held the spears from daylight till the stars appeared. At the same time, I also said to the people, let every man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by night and a working party by day. So neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me took off their clothes, except that everyone took them off for washing, which was kind of a nice, generous thing to do. The situation was extreme. In extreme times, you have to do extreme things. You have to be willing to do extreme things in that sense, in terms of response. He said his own servants himself, they never even took their clothes off. Why? Well, when we were in Nebraska, there were tornadoes would come through every year through Omaha. And there was what we called kind of a tornado alley. There was an angle down one end of the city where tornadoes would come in. And There were times when I would sit out on the front porch and I would watch the funnel clouds. You know, this greenish, dark greenish clouds and wall clouds come by, and you'd watch these spinning donuts of the clouds, and once in a while they'd spike down into a little funnel and go back up. Of course, Michelle's always screaming at me from in the house because she's down there with babies and I'm out here looking to see if I get a good shot for the movies. But I'd be watching go by, and you know, I must have been saying something here when I was bringing this up. Oh, yeah, extreme. Well, you'd go back into the house and you'd turn on the news and it would be telling you where these tornadoes were touching and where the patterns were, the storm clouds, the funnel clouds and stuff. Well, I'd never get undressed to go to bed. We'd be laying there and I'm fully clothed. Michelle says, "Are you going to bed?" And I says, "Yes." "Are you getting undressed?" "No." I said, "You think someone's going to be out there with an ambulance and I'm going to be in my underwear on the news tonight?" I said, "There's no way. If I'm on the news, I'm going to be clothed." And I remember in the Army as well, we never ever took off, in Vietnam, in the field, we never took our clothes off until we changed them. A helicopter every 4 days would bring out and drop clothes, and we'd change and send the others out, but we kept our clothes on 24 hours a day. Because what are you going to do in the middle of the night if you have to jump up and you're naked? Who can fight naked? I mean, what kind of war would that be? We'd all be laughing at each other and stuff, and war would be over, everybody go home. I mean, that's just not effective at all. We didn't even, if we felt totally safe, we took off our boots. Totally safe, you never took your clothes off, we take off our boots. If we felt that anything under threat, we didn't take our boots off. You just go and you just lay down. I remember time and time again laying down soaking wet, soggy from the rain, your boots on, your clothes on, you just lay down and you go to bed. And you dry out as you sleep. I remember seeing men so tired from day after day of rain and slogging around and not getting good sleep. I remember seeing one guy lay down in the mud in the middle of a trail with water running down the trail, lay down, roll up in his rain poncho, and just lay down in the mud and the water and go to sleep. I could not personally believe that. I wasn't to that point yet. But I look at that, and when I see this in here, and he said we didn't take our clothes off, I think, you know, that's an extreme circumstance. That's very diligent effort. You think at any moment in time your life could be in danger and you're ready to jump and run. And that's how dedicated Nehemiah was. He was there with the people and he was doing what they had to do and they saw that. And it was something like that, that personal example with God's blessing that gave them the ability to rise up and do the work in the face of danger. Brethren, leadership is important, and example is important, and our example to each other, participating, is very important. We get discouraged if nobody shows up to Bible study. We get discouraged if nobody comes to church, or to work projects, or to activities, or to practice, or whatever. You know, when we have things, and if it doesn't seem like it's important to anybody but us, it is. It has an impact. And so we do. We support each other, and it's important. But Nehemiah set that kind of example. Later on through the book, I don't want to go through all the examples because it is just a Bible study, not an ongoing seminar. But he organized the temple staff, and he chose subordinates who were faithful to God. And the people could see that those he chose were men that could be trusted, and it gave him courage and confidence. He ensured that the expenses would be properly met. He collected the tithes and the offerings and the first fruits and saw that they were distributed for the needs of the temple and the Levites and the priest and for the people that had need of the assistance that was there. He put the Levites and the priests into their courses of service in the temple so that there were schedules of service like David had done. So he's very organized. He's an administrator. But he was a leader in the sense that he was one-on-one with the people, and the people were responsive to that. Now, that's one thing. You have to turn to God. It's another thing you do your part. But sometimes a lack of courage causes us to draw back. Sometimes we draw back because of fear or insecurity or frustration or weariness. You know, I find that if I've had a frustrating day and I just, even in my own mind, I'm unsettled, around 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night, I'm just so burnt that there's nothing left I can produce. And I find that if I really feel good and I've accomplished something and I feel just mentally stronger, many times I'll sit up and read till midnight and I can concentrate and focus. And I find so much how much I am able to accomplish and produce is based on the state of mind that I'm in. And so Nehemiah here not only looked to God and was willing to do his part, but he had a certain courage and conviction that was infectious on the people as well. He could walk in. I have to laugh. Larry Walker was here visiting last week, and he spent the night with us, and maybe in the course of the sermon I'll mention something we were doing together. But Larry's a funny kind of guy. He, back when the church was in trouble, and we were all still in worldwide, and Larry was down in El Paso, and I was in Midland, and Larry was enjoying the fight a little too much. And I kept telling him, I said, Larry, you know, you got to, you know, I used to portray him as running around with a knife in his teeth, you know, like you see in the movies, you know, the Green Beret going over the wall. I said, Larry, that's not how you do it. I said, the way you do this is you do it out of duty. You fight because, I mean, soldiers go to war, they're not supposed to be bloodthirsty, you know, they're supposed to be out there saving their country, protecting their family, doing this because they have to make a sacrifice. I said, you're enjoying this, this is not right, you know. I said, but what it was Larry has a certain courage, honestly. He likened it once to like the frontiersman. It's what makes the frontiersman go out there to get a silly little beaver pelt at the risk of his life. But that Larry's kind of like that. He has that, and I always we used to tease him, but he used to draw a contrast between the frontiersmen and the settlers. Settlers would come along when there was something in it for the gain, and the frontiersmen kind of went out there for whether there was or not. And he was, Nehemiah had a courage where, in that sense, he was willing to go ahead and run out there a little bit on the front, and. In doing so, he did it in a way that inspired courage and conviction in the people that were around him. Nehemiah 5. It's one thing to fight against your enemies courageously. Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arab, Gershom. But there were problems internally as well. And he showed just as much conviction internally as he did against those who opposed him or didn't respond on the outside. Nehemiah 5, verse 1. It says, there was a great outcry of the people and their wives against the Jewish brethren. For there were those who said, we are sons, our daughters are many, therefore let us get grain for them that we may eat and live. And there were also some who said, we've mortgaged our lands and our vineyards and houses to buy grain because of the famine. And there were those who said, we've borrowed money for the king's tax on our lands and vineyards. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, as children as their children. And indeed we're forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves, and some of slaves. And some of our daughters are brought into slavery already. Is it not in our power to redeem them? For other men have our it is not in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and our vineyards. The people of the land who were being taken advantage of were crying out because they were being oppressed. And Nehemiah says, verse 6, I became very angry when I heard their outcry and these words. And after serious thought, I rebuked the nobles and the rulers, and I said to them, each of you is exacting usury from his brother. And I called a great assembly against them. You know, the fact is, you do not have to do everything in private. Some things need to be done in private, but some things need to be done with open rebuke. And there's biblical precedent for that in a very responsible way. He says, I called a great assembly against them, and I said to them, according to our ability, we have redeemed our Jewish brethren who were sold to the nations. Now indeed, will you even sell your brethren, or should they be sold to us? Then they were silenced and found nothing to say. Then I said, what you're doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? I also, with my brethren and my servants, am lending them money and grain. Please, let us stop this usury. Restore now to them. He did this in public. What could they say? Here's the crowd. He gathered the people together. He stood up with the leaders, and then he spoke to them all, but he spoke to the leaders in front of the brethren, the people of the nation here. Restore now to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive groves, their houses, and their hundredth part of the money and the grain, the new wine and the oil that you have charged them. And they said, we will restore it and will require nothing from them. We will do as you say. Then I called the priests and required an oath from them that they would do according to this promise. Then I shook out the fold of my garment and said, so may God shake out each man from his house and from his property who does not perform this promise, and thus may he be shaken out and emptied. And all the congregation said, amen, and praise the Lord. Amen. Praise the Lord. Where did we hear that? See, that came out of here too. It says, then the people did according to this promise. And so, again, we've kind of built a culture where everything is very sensitively done, and I've mentioned in the past that we're kind of politically correct. We even have a politically correct movement in the church where everything's done very gently and carefully and softly. And the fact is, there are times, now it doesn't say he just did this and in some big rash manner. He said, verse 7, after serious thought, he thought through it. It wasn't an off-the-cuff remark. He didn't just backhand somebody. He thought through it. He decided that it needed serious action, bold action to be taken, and he took it. He was willing to do so. And I realize different cultures are tolerant of different things, but Nehemiah was a very strong, bold individual, and I think in the church sometimes we have to be willing to be rather bold as well. Unfortunately, at times in the church it becomes self-serving. It has to be directed in God's service in a right and proper way. Nehemiah made great sacrifices out of his own resources and funds. Verse 14. Moreover, from the time I was appointed to be governor of the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, 12 years. Now keep that in mind. It says that he served as governor for 12 years. That's important because Nehemiah makes two trips to Jerusalem. The first one was from the 20th to the 32nd year of the king, 12 years, and that counts for the first 12 chapters of the book of Nehemiah. And then chapter 13 is another additional trip. I'm running out of time here. I hope I can get through some of that. It says that he gave of his own money and resources. He paid his own way. He had people at his own table for which he paid for their support. He did not demand the governor's provisions because the bondage was heavy on the people. He had the resources to do so. He had rich and abundant resources of his own, and he had the support of the king of Persia, and he drew money from that too. He says, remember me, my God, for good according to all that I have done for this people. So, chapter 6. There's a section here again that shows his courage and conviction that he would not back off. I think one thing Mr. Armstrong had that I personally have admired was courage. He really did have a courage in the face of adversity to advance and to take a chance in that sense to do God's will as he believed that to be. I don't think we can really serve God without courage, without a very strong conviction in that way. So now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, and the rest of their enemies heard that they had rebuilt the wall, that there were no breaks left in it, though at that time I had not hung the doors in the gates, that Sanballat and Geshem sent to me, says, come, let us meet together in one of the villages in the plain of Ono. That should have been a real giveaway right there. Oh no. But they thought to do me harm. So I sent messengers to them and said, I'm doing a great work, so I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave and go down to you? They sent this message four times, and I answered them the same manner. Then Sanballat sent his servant to me as before a fifth time, this time with an open letter in his hand. What's an open letter? They sent them in like a scroll, and they would be sealed with the king's signature on it or a little emblem of wax or something. But when you send an open letter and you send the courier off with it, what does the courier do when he gets out about 20 miles? He reads it. He says, hey, I got news from the king here. You think this would be interesting? So the first time he takes a lunch break, he opens the letter and he reads it. Well, then he stops at the bar for refreshment on this trip as he's going to where he's going and has a couple of beers. And what do you think he does? well, hey, boys, you know, you wouldn't believe what's going on. You can't imagine, you know. And so he's sitting there, he's going to pass the word. Well, that's why it was sent unsealed, because they were trying to incite the people and cause them to fear and to worry. And in the letter it says, it's reported among the nations, and Geshem says that you and the Jews plan to rebel. Therefore, according to these rumors, you are rebuilding the wall that you may be their king. And you have also appointed prophets to proclaim concerning you at Jerusalem, there is a king in Judah. Now these matters will be reported to the king, so come therefore and let us take counsel together. And I sent to him and said, no such things as you say are being done. You've invented them out of your own heart. For they were all trying to make us afraid, saying their hands will be weakened in the work, and it will not be done. Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. Throughout the book, over and over again, before he makes decisions in the midst of trial and trouble, he constantly turns to God and says, God, strengthen my hands. So afterwards I came to the house of Shemaiah, the son of whoever that is. You know, I always tell myself, you know, I had to go through this and look up all these words, and I've got a pronouncing Bible at home, and since I'm not a Hebrew scholar nor even an English scholar, as it comes out, go through and pronounce all these words, and what I usually do is just try to skip them and nobody notices, but once in a while I venture too far into a sentence and catch myself. So now you know my secret. Anyway, these people here, there was a secret informer. And he said, let us meet together in the house of God within the temple. Let us close the doors of the temple. They're coming to kill you. Indeed, at night they're going to come to kill you. What would you say if someone said they're going to kill you? You better hide. Well, it'd be tempting not to hide under the circumstances that you really believe that they were going to do that. He said, such a man as I flee, and who is there such as I would go into the temple to save his life? I will not do it. I will not go in. Then I perceived that God had not sent him at all, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. For this reason he was hired, that I should be afraid and act this way and sin, so that they might have occasion for an evil report and reproach me. My God, remember Tobiah and Sanballat according to their works, and the prophetess Nodiah and the rest of the prophets who have made me afraid. And so he did have to from time to time stabilize his knees, but he still did so and went on. Now, how did I do this? We're down to 5 minutes, and I've got half. I'm on page 3 of 5. Let me see. Question arises when you look at the timing of this. Nehemiah 8 is where the law was given. When you read through there and you see where Ezra stood up and read before the people, and the people all stood up and read, and it was remarkable here, event, Ezra reads the law. But Ezra came first before Nehemiah was there, and then Nehemiah came, and Nehemiah was there for about 12 years as governor as well. And so what you sometimes wonder is, what was it that took so long to put this back into place and to read the law and to reestablish the people? Well, back in the book of Ezra, one of the first things Ezra did when he arrived in chapters 9 and 10 was to get the people to put away their foreign wives and the children. And we went through that, or if we didn't, I can't recover everything, I suppose. But the Jews put away their wives and their children. It was a effect that was not easily done. Many of those wives and children then returned to their families in where? In the neighboring nations around about. What would that have done to those nations? Would have made them angry as fire. You can imagine if all these women and children come flooding home out of Judah, and you're already not particularly disposed to these people. Ezra comes in and all this flood comes home, and what it did was it just increased the antagonism against the Jews. Now, in that context, Ezra 4, we went through that in the last Bible study, and I showed you that there is an insert in the middle of that chapter. And in the middle of chapter 4, there is a letter that goes to Artaxerxes in regard to the Jews rebuilding the wall. Now, even though it's in chapter 4 of Ezra, it's later than chapters 9 and 10, because it's an insert. It's been brought back in and said, you know, they troubled the Jews during this king and that king, and also during Artaxerxes here. And so you see that context. What happened was Ezra came back, the women and children were sent home, and the people were angered, and they complained to the king who had given Ezra permission to go back and to rebuild Jerusalem. In the meantime, the king had got into war with Greece. And at the same time, Egypt was a subject nation of the Persian Empire. And Greece was fighting against Persia, and Egypt was threatening to rebel, and Ezra had gone down and irritated all the neighbors, was the effect. And all of a sudden, the neighbors complained to the king of Persia, and we have secular records to show that these wars and other events took place. All of a sudden, we have complaints against Ezra and his people that are rebuilding the wall to defend themselves. The king of Persia is now being threatened with rebellion in Egypt on one end and with war with Greece on the other. And so the king says, stop, cease. And Ezra was shut down. Now it's worse than before. Your neighbors are mad and angry. The king who gave you permission to rebuild and restore Jerusalem has now revoked your permission, and you don't have the defenses of a wall. Who are the people going to blame? They're going to blame Ezra, because Ezra came in and said, well, if you do this, God will bless you. They did it, and it looked like they got cursed. And now they have enemies right next to them, and they have no permission to finish their defenses. Ezra is all of a sudden a bad guy instead of a good guy, and he doesn't have the moral authority anymore to direct the people back to God. And that's what happened historically around about these times, and is why Nehemiah then had to come as governor and add his weight to the system to turn it back to God. And again, there's for time's sake, I won't be able to give you all the dates and the activities there, but in a nutshell, that's what happened. Let's go to Nehemiah 13. Let's go to the end. We started a few minutes late getting started, and let's go about maybe 5 minutes past. I just want to go through Nehemiah 13. Nehemiah made two trips. First trip was 12 years. The second trip he returns, Nehemiah 13 verse 4. It says, before this, Eliashib the priest, having authority over the storerooms of the house of our God, was allied with Tobiah. And I mentioned that in the beginning of the study. He had prepared for him a large room where previously they had stored grain offerings, frankincense, and articles, the tithes of grain, new wine, and oil, which were commanded to be given to the Levites and singers and gatekeepers, and offerings for the priests. And so you have here a room in the temple was actually provided for Tobiah, who was one of the enemies of the Jews, because Tobiah was an ally of Eliashib, the high priest. The high priest moves out the room for the offerings, cleans it out, and gives Tobiah an apartment, kind of a time-sharing condo right in the temple. And so now we have Nehemiah, verse 6. But during all of this, I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king. Remember, he said, the king asked him, how long are you going to be gone? He says he gave him a time. Well, he didn't say what, but we see here that he stayed for 12 years, and then he went home. And then all this fell apart again in Jerusalem, and all the evils simply returned. The people turned aside. And then he says, after certain days, I obtained leave from the king. So Nehemiah then had to go back. And he begins to address the problems. And I came to Jerusalem, verse 7. This is a whole second trip. Discovered the evil Eliashib had done for Tobiah in preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of God, and it grieved me bitterly. Therefore I threw all the household goods of Tobiah out of the room, and I commanded them to cleanse the rooms, and brought back into them the articles of the house of God, the grain offering, and the frankincense. And I also realized that the portions of the Levites had not been given to them, for each of the Levites and the singers who did the work had gone back to his field. So I contended with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together, and I set them in their place. And then all Judah brought the tithe, the grain, the oil, the new wine, the oil to the storehouse. And I appointed as treasurer over the storehouse, and he mentions the individuals here that are appointed, because they were faithful. So See, I was that able to see it in advance there and jump over the names real smoothly in that case. He said, because they were faithful and their task was to distribute to their brethren. Remember me, O God, concerning this, and do not wipe out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for its services. In those days I saw in Judah some people treading the wine presses on the Sabbath, bringing in sheaves, loading donkeys with wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them about the day in which they were selling provisions. So he had to address the Sabbath. The Sabbath was being ignored. When people begin to turn away from God, they turn away from the Sabbath. They turn away from zeal. They turn away from the tithes and offerings. They hold back. They get slack. And Nehemiah had to come back and restore the people to obedience to God. And he shut the gates on the Sabbath day. And he says in verse 20, when all the merchants and the sellers of all kinds of wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice, I warned them and said, why do you spend the night around the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you. And from that time on, they came no more on the Sabbath. And I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves, that they should go and guard the gates and sanctify the Sabbath day. Sanctify means to set apart for a holy purpose. It's not a matter of not going to work. It's a matter of using the day well, sanctifying it, dedicating it to God. It's not enough to rest. It's a day for special opportunities of service, of study, of family, of growth and development in a spiritual way. We can't just avoid our work and keep the Sabbath. That's simply not how the Sabbath was ordained. In those days, I also saw Jews who married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of one or the other people. And I contended with them, and I cursed and struck at them and pulled their hair out. Boy, we'd get rid of him now. I mean, that's just not what we're accustomed to. Anybody did that couldn't possibly. Anybody that got that zealous in his response couldn't possibly be called of God to do his service, could he? Obviously, I speak as a fool. It was a different culture. I'm not suggesting we go to that mode, but I am suggesting that sometimes in our politically correct society, we have softened our expectations so much that sometimes a little bit of zeal is misinterpreted as a crazy man. Need not always be so. Saying, you shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take your daughters to your sons or yourselves. Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him who was beloved of his God, and God had blessed him in an enormous way, and yet these wives still turned him away from God. God made him king over all of Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin, and there is the key. It's not an issue of race. It's an issue of religion. It's an issue of worship and obedience to God. Pagan women caused even him close to God to sin. Should we then hear of your doing all this great evil, transgressing against our God by marrying pagan women? It says, and one of the sons of Joiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was a son-in-law of Sanballat. Therefore I drove him from me. It's interesting. Sanballat was the appointed governor, the leader over the Samaritans. Where was the rival temple set up to the Jewish temple, to the Israelite temple, to God's temple in Jerusalem? Where was the rival temple set up? In Samaria. That was the rival religion of the day. The individual here in verse number 28 who was one of the sons here of the high priest, one of the descendants of the high priest, was also married to the daughter of the ruler of Samaria. He went to Samaria when he was driven out and set up the rival temple and religion of the Samaritans, the high priest of the Samaritans. You find those areas in terms of Simon Magus and others when you get later on down, the religion that was embedded in the country. But the temple was set up by the individual here that was cast out. And the high priests of the Samaritan religion descend from this family line. Now again, there's other historical commentaries and things that address some of those issues. But this was a very serious provocation, and the evil and the pagan influence was very, very deep. Now, after Nehemiah returned and stayed, it appears, at least in his lifetime, the law was maintained in Judah to a much better degree. The scribal schools, the synagogues were able to maintain their operation. And Josephus records that Nehemiah lived a long life and governed Judah right up to his death. But the story of Nehemiah is the story of Israel. When Israel has a leader who is strong and dedicated to God, they follow him. And when Israel does not, they turn aside. Isn't it amazing that even in the church, that process seems to also have a great impact? When the leaders are strong and dedicated to God, the people respond, and when they aren't, the people turn aside. We are Israel. We are supposed to be spiritual Israel with the law in our hearts. But it would appear that God is having to make decision and discernment in terms of where that law really and truly and deeply has been placed.